Okay. Welcome, everybody. Well, let's start again. Let's pause 4 seconds and then I'll start. Hello, everybody. This is A Journey Through History. Today is November 7th, 2023, and we are discussing the book The Wager. And you'll have to forgive me. I cannot remember the author's name to save my life, but we'll let Don provide that information, or we'll let the recording provide that information.
It's
So,
it'll get it. You'll get it.
okay. So
You
that's enough
ready?
from me. Yep.
All right, I'm going to mute everybody when we're done. Don, don't forget, Alt A will unmute you. So here we go.
This is Tuesday, November the 7th, 2023. This is Don Queen with Accessible World's Journey Through History. Our book for this evening is Wager, A Tale of Shipwreck, Mutiny, and Murder by David Gran.
At the bottom of the world, below the tip of South America, the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans converge to form one of the most dangerous places to find yourself in a boat, the Drake Passage. In the mid-18th century, a squadron of British warships made the journey through the passage in the worst weather imaginable, suffering terrible damage to their ships. One man of war called the Wager went missing and wrecked upon the rocks of a desolate island off Patagonia. At first, the castaways maintained the naval laws and discipline of the British Empire under their captain, but that unraveled under the hardships they endured, including poor shelter, punishing weather, and starvation. There was murder and cannibalism, and the captain lost the respect of his crew, especially after killing one of the sailors by shooting him. Eventually, the majority of the men mutinied and sailed away on a makeshift craft, leaving behind their captain and a small band loyal to him. They sailed nearly 3,000 miles to rescue in Brazil, but only 29 of the 81 survived the journey. Miraculously, the captain survived as well. The leaders of the mutineers and the captain were reunited in England at a court-martial hearing to decide whether they were guilty of the crimes of mutiny and murder. David Grand writes about this harrowing journey in his new book, The Wager, A Tale of Shipwreck, Mutiny, and Murder. Well, David Grand, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's so great to be back on the program.
So your book takes place in the 1740s when the British Empire went to war against its rival, Imperial Spain. And the war was called the War of Jenkins' Ear, and we can leave that to readers to find out why it had that name. But there was a secret mission that a squadron of five British warships took. Tell us about that mission and where they were going.
Yeah, so they were given a secret mission to try to intercept and capture a Spanish galleon filled with so much treasure, it was known as the prize of all the oceans. And so they were going to sail across the Atlantic, around the violent seas of Cape Horn, into the Pacific, and then try to intercept the ship somewhere off the coast of the Philippines.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a heist movie, but like, isn't this piracy? Isn't this almost illegal during that time?
It wasn't illegal. It was actually it was the end of a certain era of buccaneering. But in that period, seamen were offered a tantalizing prospect, which was a share of the prize money. So yes, there really was a piratical element to this secret mission.
And can you set this conflict in the larger context? Like, what were Britain and Spain fighting about?
We're seeking, this was the This was the kind of terrible age of empires, and Great Britain was seeking to expand its empire into Latin America and break its rival Spain's hold over that region.
And as I said in the introduction, even today, rounding Cape Horn is considered very dangerous. What makes it so tricky?
Oh, it is the worst. It is among the worst, if not the worst, seas in the world. And the reason is that the seas travel uninterrupted, unblocked by any land around the globe. And so they travel about 13,000 miles without having anything to slow them down. And then they funnel around Cape Horn. A 90-foot wave can dwarf a ship's mast. The currents are the strongest on Earth. And then there are the winds, which can accelerate to as much as 200 miles per hour. Herman Melville, who later made the trek around the Horn, compared it to a descent into hell in Dante's Inferno.
And you say, like, they're facing these waves, which they have to ascend and descend, and then, like, in the hollows of the waves, there are these deadly icebergs.
Yes, they have to navigate through a typhoon, or what they refer to as the perfect hurricane. There are tidal waves.
One of the things I found fascinating was that this is before the Panama Canal, obviously, but the Spanish would prefer to just cross Panama rather than sail around the Cape.
That is how terrifying Cape Horn was to seamen, that the Spanish decided that for their trade, they would take their cargo ship, sail to Panama, and then haul the goods across the jungle, suffering malaria and yellow fever, and then load the goods on the other side of Panama onto ships into the Pacific. So that was just a testament to how terrifying these seas really were.
Yeah. Now, the Wager, the ship that you focus on, was not built as a man of war. It was actually a merchant ship that was purchased by the Navy and refurbished for battle. You say it was tubby and unwieldy.
Yeah, it was a little bit like the ugly duckling of the squadron because it had not been born for battle. It had been one of these merchant ships that had been remade into a warship to serve in the war. It was the lowest rated ship. And in that period, they rated warships by the number of cannons, and the Wager at 28, so it was a 6 rate, which was the lowest rate. And it had been named after the head of the Admiralty at the time, a man named Sir Charles Wager.
So these boats also needed a lot of sailors to work properly. You say that the Centurion, the flagship of this mission, needed 400 sailors, and that's only one of the ships going on the mission. There are four other warships, there's a scouting boat, and two cargo ships. They all needed personnel, but the Navy was having a hard time recruiting enough men. What means did they resort to find the manpower?
Yeah, so the Great Britain at that time did not have conscription, and it had exhausted its supply of volunteers during this war for the Navy. And so for the squadron, which was desperately short of men, and men were the most essential element, you needed skilled seamen to operate these very complex vessels. And so what they did was they dispatched the press gangs, and the press gangs would roam into cities, they would roam into ports and towns, and they would look for anyone with the telltale signs of a mariner. You know, if you had even a little tar on the tips of your fingertips, tar was used on a ship a lot, they would say, oh, you're a mariner. They would round you up, they would put you on these basically like these floating jails and take you out to the ship, and you were forced to go unwillingly on a voyage that might last 3 years. Even then, the squadron was short of men, so the Admiralty took the extreme step of rounding up soldiers from a retirement home, many of whom were in their 60s and 70s. They were missing an assortment of limbs. Some were so sick they needed to be lifted on stretchers onto these ships before the voyage. Everybody knew they were sailing to their deaths.
Back to the press gangs for a second. You describe how the press gangs would row out to returning merchant ships, and these are ships that may have been out in sea for years, and would snatch sailors off those boats so that the sailors wouldn't be able to see their families. They would be put right back onto another boat. And then also you describe how there's this poignant scene where family and wives would go to the docks looking for their loved ones, trying to peer into the floating jails to see if they could get one last glimpse of the men before they were sent off again. Let's talk a little bit about life on board these boats. Although they were huge vessels, there were so many sailors that unless you were, say, like the captain, you didn't have a lot of personal space, right?
The captain had a great cabin, a large cabin with a balcony overlooking the sea. Petty officers were in very small quarters, and the seamen had to sleep on hammocks separated only by about a foot at most.
There was a lot of documentation that happened on these boats. A lot of the officers would keep logbooks, even some non-officers would keep logbooks. Why were these so important?
Yes, the Admiralty and the British Empire and the government required the senior officers all to keep a logbook, the captain and lieutenant, of almost a daily occurrence of the wind and the elements and unexpected accidents and remarkable incidents. And this was partly a way for the British Empire, which was during this age of ruthless expansion, these documents provided a kind of encyclopedic knowledge of what the world was like, what these uncharted seas were like. All this was being fueled back to the empire for further trade and conquest. These documents were also very important because if anything happened on a ship, let's say there was a mutiny or a shipwreck or something went wrong, they would become entered into evidence at a court-martial, and officers were instructed not to alter them or to edit them because it raised suspicions.
And some of the logbooks of the Wager survived the wreck, and you actually got to read them. What was that like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's hard to fathom how some of these documents survived typhoons and the tidal waves and the shipwreck and made it back. And you can hold these incredibly brittle documents from the 18th century. You know, you open them up in a box and you pull them out. You know, dust just blows out of them. The covers are almost disintegrating. But they are a wealth of information and let you to really meticulously reconstruct this expedition from day to day. There are muster books, there are log books, there are journals, and much more.
So David, there's two important characters in your book that will become like the opposing poles in the mutiny. One is the captain, David Cheap, and he actually starts this journey to South America as a second in command of a different boat, but he's promoted to captain of the Wager after its captain dies. Give us a little sense of him.
Yeah, so Captain Cheap was somebody who on land was plagued by debts and chased by creditors, but he had always found refuge on the regimented, you know, wooden world of a ship. And on this voyage, he had finally obtained what he had always longed for. It was his deep ambition, which was to be captain of his own warship and to have a chance to possibly capture a lucrative prize.
Right. And the other character is John Bulkley, who was the gunner of the Wager. And the gunner is in charge of the boat's munitions and was usually a very responsible and reliable person, which would describe Bulkley. He was considered a natural leader among the sailors.
Yes, he was in many ways the most skilled seaman on board the Wager. He was, as you said, an instinctive leader, but because he did not come from the aristocracy or from the wealthier classes, he knew that it was unlikely that he would ever have a chance to become a commander of his own warship like David Cheap, the captain.
Okay, one of the biggest enemies the squadron has to face was disease. First, as the warships are crossing the Atlantic, there's a typhus breakout, and typhus is carried in the feces of lice, just for anyone who didn't know that. And then as the boats are beginning the most difficult part of their journey around Cape Horn, they are struck with a second disease, scurvy. We now know that scurvy is caused by a vitamin C deficiency, and it's actually easy to prevent and to cure by eating citrus. But at the time, people didn't know this. Ships didn't carry citrus on board or really any fruits and vegetables, and the sailors were defenseless against the disease. It sounds like scurvy was a ticking time bomb to any boat that traveled over a certain amount of time.
That is true. Scurvy killed more seamen than, you know, all the other potential dangers at ship, you know, tempests and other diseases combined. And as the squadron and the Wager were sailing around Cape Horn at a point when the ships are just being bandied about like these rowboats in these gigantic seas, and they need every person to persevere, they begin to suffer from scurvy. And they don't know what causes it, but their hair begins to fall out, their teeth fall out, and as some seamen say, the disease got into their brains and they went raving mad.
Okay, so the ships are making their attempt to round Cape Horn. How did it go?
Oh, not so well. you know, they are being, you know, they lack men. At one point, I think at one of the more extraordinary moment, they can't even fly their sails because they keep blowing out. And so, but they, if they take down all the sails, they can't control the ship. So they, one of the commanders orders his men to climb the mast during this storm while the ships are rocking violently, and to use their bodies as these threadbare sails so that the captain can help turn the ship. So imagine this, you have these men and boys standing 100 feet in the air, their bodies concave as a gale force wind blows against them. And the captain was able to turn the ship around, but one of the men was lost and fell into the sea, and the others could see him desperately swimming after the ship futilely.
Yeah, that's an amazing part of the story. So he doesn't want to use sails because the winds are so strong, but so he just needs a little bit of power and control, and so that's why he has these sailors go up there and act as sails.
Exactly. You know, there's a very few people join that elite club of Cape Horners who A, want to go around the Horn and ever come back. There's, you know, if anyone reads Melville, he has amazing descriptions of Cape Horn, and he basically says heaven help the, you know, the family members if one of their loved ones is going around the Horn.
What about you? Are you adventurous, or do you like to find your adventure in pages of books and documents?
Well, I am the least likely adventurer possible in so many ways. I'm half blind. I'm older. I'm bald. I get lost on a subway, even on my way to work. and I spend most of my time in archives researching these stories. As I did for The Wager, I spent the first 2 years just combing archives, reading these journals and books with a magnifying glass. These places are very suited for my paltry physical attributes. But then there usually comes a time whenever I research these books or stories where some doubt gnaws at me, some part of the story I don't fully feel like I understand, and I get propelled on some mad expedition, you know, to try to better understand what happened. And so in the case of The Wager, I eventually organized my own little expedition to try to get to Wager Island.
You don't round Cape Horn, right?
I do not round Cape yeah. Horn. I hope I never do. It was rough enough as it was.
Okay, let's get back to The Wager. First of all, just how long does it take to round Cape Horn?
Well, they are struggling to get around it for months because every time they think they get around it, they don't. And the ships are breaking apart. Some of the ships end up turning back. So it takes, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks as they attempt to get around the Horn.
But they do succeed finally. But the boat is in terrible shape. They're no longer with the rest of the squadron. I think the squadron believes that The Wager has sunk. Most of the crew, including the captain, has scurvy. They can't do their jobs at all or very well, and the ship wrecks. Some of the crew believe, and this will be a factor in the mutiny, that it's the captain's fault, that Captain Cheap was so single-minded on his mission that he didn't really seem to pay attention, that the boat had drifted into shallow waters. So the boat starts getting ripped apart by rocks and bringing on water. Fortunately, it gets wedged between some rocks, and so it doesn't completely sink, and that gives the sailors an opportunity to get in their small transport boats and row to this desolate island. And this is not the most hospitable island for castaways, is it?
No. The captain, you know, determinedly, you know, gets around the Horn and is trying to sail the ship up the coast of Patagonia in Chile, hoping to eventually rendezvous with the rest of the squadron. But in those days, seamen didn't really know exactly where they were on the map because they could not determine their longitude. Longitude required a reliable clock, which had not yet been invented. And so Cheap and his navigator's estimation of their longitude turns out to be not only wrong, but wrong by hundreds of miles. And they suddenly smash into this rock, and an anchor falls through the floor of the ship. The rudder shatters, and then the ship is just careening through this minefield until it does become wedged between these rocks and begins to completely rip apart. Water surges under the bottom into the ship. Rats are scurrying upward. Those who are suffering from scurvy, who could not get out of their hammocks, drown. But in the distance, some of the survivors see this through the mist, this desolate island, and they think, okay, maybe this will be our salvation. And they get there in one of these transport boats, about nearly 150 of them. And instead, the island turns out to be the beginning of their hell. It is cold and windy. It's constantly raining and sleeting. And worst of all, they can find virtually no food. One British officer compared the island to a place where the soul of man dies in him.
Right. They were starving. They were cold. They had to scrape seaweed off of rocks to eat. They have a few supplies left from the boat, but the captain takes those and puts them in a tent and rations them out to make them last. But the castaways are on the road to starvation. And one of the most remarkable moments during the castaways' time on the island is that they're visited by this group of indigenous people called the Kaweskar, who come to their island by canoe. And, you know, the land that the British are on, it seems so barren and punishing to them. But the Kaweskar have perfectly adapted to their environment. Can you describe them to us?
Yeah. You know, like other Patagonians, they have been in the region, native Patagonians, they've been in the region for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so they had adapted to this very difficult environment. They traveled mostly in small familial groups. They lived almost exclusively off marine resources. And they traveled and spent much of their times in canoes. They were known as the nomads of the sea. They had learned how to stay warm. They would keep a fire going at all times, even in their canoes. And most critically, they knew the landscape and the terrain. So they knew where to find hidden shoals filled with fish or other, you know, sea urchins that could be eaten, or mussels or whatnot. So they knew how to survive. And so when they arrive, they offer the castaways a potential lifeline.
Right, which unfortunately the castaways, they cut their own lifeline.
The castaways cut their own lifeline. Many of them are blinkered by, you know, racism, this idea that somehow their civilization is superior to others. And they are also spiraling into violence and chaos. At a certain point, the Kaweskar basically just say, you know, we're out of here. And they disappear. And after that moment, the castaways descend only further into a Hobbesian state of depravity. And a few of the men even succumb to cannibalism.
Okay, so Captain Cheap is trying to maintain naval law on the island. But the system starts to break down. Some men start stealing food. When they're caught, they're punished with 600 lashes. The captain shoots a man, a midshipman, in the cheek. This man, Henry Cousins, had been accused of dereliction of duty. He eventually dies from his wounds. And the crew believes that Cheap wasn't justified in his actions. And the men's loyalty to Cheap erodes. And the sailors start looking for leadership from the gunner, John Bulkley.
Yes, they increasingly gravitate towards Bulkley, that instinctive leader who uses such populist expressions that still resonate with us today. He would use phrases to stir the seamen, calling for them for life and liberty, while Cheap invokes such principles as duty and honor and patriotism to try to keep the men loyal to him and to the mission.
We can't get into the details of the mutiny, but they finally decide to go that path. And it's so interesting to me, like, how long it takes them to get there. Like, there's all these deliberations. There's a lot of diplomacy back and forth between the factions. Like, it seems that mutiny was a really hard line for these men to cross, despite all that had happened to them.
Yes, a full-blown mutiny, they knew, was risky. A real breach of naval order. And if it was a full-blown mutiny like the kind some were contemplating, the punishment could be, or likely would be, being hanged if they ever made it back to England. So even when they are planning it, they are holding these debates. And what's amazing is that Even on this desolate remote island, the castaways are conscious of the Admiralty, you know, thousands of miles away, all the way in England, peering down on them. So they are thinking about the rules, what rules they can break. They are writing up documents and trying to create a written record contemporaneously that can justify their uprising, a written record that would withstand the attrition of a public trial.
Yeah, it's amazing. They have these little scraps of paper, and they're having all the mutineers sign them, especially the second in command. So it seems like that they were justified in their actions. And then Bulkley just takes all these pieces of paper with them on their journey.
That is correct.
Okay, so once the boat is ready, the mutineers take control of it and leave Captain Cheap along with a few remaining men loyal to him on the island. He actually requests to be left there rather than to be taken prisoner on the boat. And Bulkley and his men make this journey almost 3,000 miles successfully, but you could not call it an easy trip.
No, it was not an easy trip. And one important caveat upon leaving the captain, they didn't really leave him with a working boat to get off. And right. So I think the assumption to some degree, or at least from Cheat's point of view, is he was being left to die so that he could never share his story. So if the others made it back to England, only one version of the tale would prevail.
So only 29 of the 81 men who take this trip survive. One actually dies, I think, as they made it to safety. And we won't get into the story, but miraculously, Captain Cheap and some of his men are rescued from the island by a group of native people. And we'll save that to the readers. But it's amazing, first of all, that these men survived. They made it to safety. Greatly diminished, but they all make it back to England. And there, the survivors engage in this sort of war of words. Like, some of the men, including Bulkley, publish accounts of their experience, in part to make money, but also to sway public opinion to their side. And this is all happening at a time of increased journalism and publishing. Can you sort of talk about that?
Yeah, there was greater literacy. Printing was cheaper. So there was a real explosion in newspaper writing, distance. And, you know, so in jostling seas, their elbows and knees are bouncing against each other.
And there could be dozens of boys on board, some as young as 6 years old. What jobs do they have?
Yeah, so I mean, what's so interesting about these ships is that they really are these floating civilizations that are almost like a test or experiment in human sociability, because people from all walks of lives and all ages are thrown onto these ships. You know, they begin as strangers, most of them. There could be boys as young as six. You could have men in their 80s. You have aristocrats, you have dandies, you have city paupers, you have professional craftsmen, you have free black seamen. They're each given a different kind of mission on the ship. The boys tended to be, they were like powder monkeys. They would, you know, run about carrying the gunpowder in battle. Many of them were there to be trained, to learn how to live on a ship so that they could grow on to become seamen. And some might even be from well-to-do families who are in training to eventually become officers.
Yeah, one of those is actually John Byron, who later is the grandfather of Lord Byron, the poet. The way you describe it, one of the more dangerous jobs on board was climbing the mainmast. Can you describe how harrowing that is?
Yeah, it's harrowing. So you mentioned John Byron, for example, this midshipman who was 16 years old when the voyage set sail. And he has to learn, you know, how to work and operate on a ship. And one of the tasks he has to do is to climb these masts that can climb as, you know, that can rise as much as 100 feet. They would have to climb along these ropes that hold up the masts on the exterior and scurry up them. You know, it wasn't like ships today where you could kind of work the sails from down on the deck. You had to go up and then climb up and climb up. Sometimes when you were climbing, your back was nearly parallel to the deck and the sea.
Right, because the ship is moving. This is not a static static pole. The ship is rocking back and forth.
No, I mean, and it's important to mention that, you know, there will come a time on this voyage where not only are they rocking back and forth, they have to do this in hurricanes and typhoons. So they are swinging as if, you know, they were spiders clinging on as the ship rocks, you know, close to 45 degrees to one side and then 45 degrees to the other. for the first time, writing kind of done by professionals for individual profit rather than patronage by the aristocracy. And so you had these profusion of accounts, and these accounts that were being released by the various seamen and members of the expedition struck a chord. And what's so important to understand is why they did this. They get back to England, and after waging a war against all these elements, they are summoned to face a court-martial where they could be hanged. So they begin to wage this war over the truth, releasing their accounts. And there is, you know, they each shape their account, probably the way we all do in some way, in order to emerge as the hero of their stories. There's a famous line from Joan Didion who said, like any of these stories.
Right. And Bulkley and Cheap, while they have a lot of concerns about each other's behavior on the ship and who is responsible for the wreckage of the ship, they decide to censor themselves because they see the way that the court-martial is going, that they're not going to have to face those more serious crimes.
Yes, and after that single proceeding about what it caused the wreck, everybody is let go. And it became, as one naval historian called it, the mutiny that never was. Hmm.
And you say that the Navy behaved this way because the whole affair had just been a public relations disaster for them and the British Empire. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so, you know, this expedition that had set out with nearly, you know, 2,000 men, more than 1,300 of them had died. It was really kind of a folly of imperialism. It was a mission kind of bungled from the start in planning. The public had clamored for war, but as so often with wars, didn't actually really want to pay for it, so they sent off their various people in many ways simply to die. Thousands and thousands of other seamen had died during other battles during this war period, and the war was kind of a bloody stalemate. And the Wager disaster was a reminder of that, but even more profoundly, it undercut that central claim that the British Empire always asserted to justify its ruthless expansion and conquering of other peoples, that its civilization was somehow superior to others. But here, when these castaways were on the island, these British officers and crew, the supposed apostles of Western civilization, they had descended into this Hobbesian state of depravity. They had behaved, you know, less like gentlemen and more like brutes. And so none of the stories that these seamen were telling, you know, in their own, well, the seamen were all battling over their stories, trying to prevail. But the British Navy and Empire was looking at these stories saying, I don't know if we like any of these stories.
Right. So how did you first come across the story?
I was doing research on mutinies when I came across the account of John Byron, the midshipman, from the Wager. And what was so interesting is his book, his account was written in this stilted old prose, this archaic prose from the 18th century. And then I thought, this crazy, weird story is like a parable for our own turbulent times.
Thank you.
I think that's it, folks. Don, Alt-A, and you can unmute.
So was that a sea shanty that was playing there at the end?
I guess.
It sure sounded like one.
Yeah, I think it was.
It did sound like one of those sea things.
Yeah. What's going? Is Don still here? Oh, there he
Yeah,
is.
I'm late.
Yeah, there he is.
Maybe he was
He's
unmuting.
still muted. Yeah.
Don sent you a thing to unmute, so.
Alt A.
Yeah, well, I sent him a prompt, so maybe if you just hit enter.
Oh, okay. Right when that
You
prompt
just press
comes.
enter on that. Yep.
Oh, yeah, they're done.
Well, you want me to start calling on people
I
until
say so. Get the
okay,
ball rolling.
let's go. So, I'm just going to say a few words first, and then I'll start calling on people and stuff. This book was, I'll admit, my maritime experience is nil. So, the ocean scares the hell out of me. I'll be honest with you guys. I mean, it always has. I mean, I've taken a couple of cruises and stuff, but I mean, I just I'm scared of it because it's so powerful and so many things can go wrong. So if you think I'm ever going to sail around the Cape Horn, forget that. I mean, I don't understand these people. They must have been crazy. And I noticed they didn't talk any about. There was one of the people that did capture that Spanish galleon had all the money on it. What didn't they? Didn't they talk about
George
that in the book?
Ensign at the end, George Ensign,
Right. Yeah, but
and that. The war cost like 50 times more than the money they got from the
yeah.
galleon.
Well, I mean, and it's so typical. The thing that struck me about this, that was the Cascar, was that the Patagonian group that, it,
Huascar.
yeah, all these people think they are civilized and stuff, and. It's the natives are the ones that are the good people, it seems like. I mean, they came in and tried to help these people, and
Yeah.
it never ceases to amaze me. I want to tell you, if I ever something ever happens to me when I'm out shopping or anything, I want it to be the poor people that come and help me, not the rich white people that are driving around in the big cars and stuff, because those are the people that have a problem with helping others, I think.
Yeah,
But
they
I
might
know,
pick your pocket.
yeah, I just it's just amazing to me. This is the classic example of, it's like he said, no wonder nobody wanted to talk about this thing after it was all over. Because I mean, yeah, I mean, all these captains and naval officers and stuff ended up, degrading and it's the natives are the ones that look like they were the ones that were. The good guys, but it was an interesting story. I mean, and David Grand does a good job of doing his research, obviously. And it's I mean, it didn't really read like a novel, which I'm not surprised. But I learned a lot. I'm glad I read it. I read the whole thing, and so it's like I say, I've got no maritime experience, and nor do I really want any. So, but it. It was a good read. So thanks for picking it. And let's see. Don's still muted. So I'm just gonna go down the list and call on people and see if I have anything to say. Now, Brad, you said you had an hour and a half to go, so you've read a good bit of it, sounds
I've
like,
read
right?
most of it.
Right,
You
right.
know, I was a little late at getting started, but I found this book hard to put down.
Yeah.
It's not a pleasant story,
Yeah.
but it is a fascinating story. I studied geography and mapping, so I was very familiar with all that stuff about longitude. It makes complete sense to me. I'll have a class on it afterwards if you're interested. No, I'm kidding. But I can understand, how difficult it was, for getting them, for them figuring it out. You had to have good clocks. They didn't have clocks. And I'm sure that's confusing why clocks matter, but anyway, so I could see how difficult that was. But still, in all my studying, I never really knew that much about this part of the world. I had no idea how brutal the weather was. Yes, I understood that it's at the higher latitudes. I understood the fee, but you know, I never have any experience with anything like that. I just kind of had vague understanding of it all, but I never really thought about the geography of that area, how the tip of South America and the Drake Passage, how they talked about how the sea floor went from being about 1300 feet to about 300 feet. And I would imagine what that is an extension of the Andes Mountains under the sea. Yeah. So, but anyway, what a brutal, brutal place to be. Brutal climate, brutal sea conditions, unbelievable. And that they, you know, were trying to go through there in the, you know, type of ships they had in that time. Unbelievable. I think they said it was taking them, they'd been trying to go around the Cape Horn. Was it 7 weeks? 7 weeks, they said, and they still never quite got as far as they thought they had, you know, in the storm. They have no idea where they are. They're just, you know, like you said, dead reckoning, which is another word for guesstimating where they are, you know, and then to find out, oh no, we're about to hit an island. We're not as far as we were, you know, they really had no clue where they were.
Yeah.
And then to survive that island sounded just the most inhospitable place, you know, and then they meet the natives who basically were saving their lives. But of course, men will be men, and they, you know, they just wanted to fool around with the women, and the guy said, we're out of here. Yeah. And they left them, and they never came back. Now, I have another hour and a half to go, so we'll see. Apparently, they did come back, and that somebody came back and rescued the captain. But I thought it was a fascinating story, like I said. It was very good. Good choice. I enjoyed it.
I had to kind of laugh with the guy during the interview, the recording that you played for. I think the Spanish had it right. I mean, I think I'd rather, you know, sail up to Panama and trek across the land and stuff instead of those seas and stuff. Just
well, when like you also consider, you know, how many thousands of miles it is to go around. See, I always thought, built the Panama Canal. Yeah, it was because it was such a long way around South America, kind of like when they built Suez Canal.
Right.
Big shortcuts, so you don't have to go around Africa. But I don't believe going around the Cape of Good Hope and southern tip of Africa is nearly as treacherous as this was. So was more than just, you know, a shortcut, so you didn't have to go around South America. That was he said, still to this day, with modern shipping, it's one of the most dangerous parts of the world's oceans. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, good comments. Let's see. Betsy.
I did not finish it because I didn't see the fact till last week that we had switched books. We're still working on it. The title just said history, whatever it usually says, and I didn't read it right away to realize we had switched books.
Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, we tried to put it. I tried to put it in the subject line, we realized that the book we talked about in the meeting last month, we had already talked about back in 2022. So what was the name of the one we were going to talk about?
Peril.
Right.
I went and looked
it
up.
I didn't have that in my folder even, so I don't know where it went.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's see.
It was good it still reminded me of Captain James Cook because he went through some of those same areas.
Right.
So it was interesting.
Okay. All right.
Alan, I have to leave soon. So.
Go ahead, Johnny. Go ahead.
Well, I really, really was fascinated by this book. The things that really stuck out for me were how these men lived through all the starvation, the diseases, and the waves that came at them. You would think that most of them would die. I mean, a lot of them did. but and I could see Cheeps both sides of how he felt. He wanted to do the right thing, and he didn't know what the right thing was. And I kind of liked him, especially in the beginning. And I liked Bulkley or whatever his name was. I couldn't put the book down either. I thought it was totally fascinating. When I first saw it, the wager, you think it's about somebody betting on something, and it turns out it's the name of a ship and the name of an island. And I don't know who recommended it, but thank you very much. I was glued to it, and there were a lot of things that I was thinking that I would say about it, but now I can't remember them. So anyway, I did really enjoy the book, and I'd love to know what the book for December is, because I'm going to have to leave in a few minutes.
Okay, well, maybe...
I'll let you know, Joni. I'll send you an email with the DB number.
Oh, okay, Brad.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I guess you could say the name of the ship was kind of appropriate, because they were wagering a lot of men's lives and stuff to go out and try to get gold and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, okay. Thanks, Joni. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Let's see.
Thank you,
David. David Fauché.
Hi. It was an interesting book, very dark. I'm glad it wasn't any longer than it was, though, because after 8 hours, I'd had enough.
Yeah.
It was good. I had heard of impressment. I didn't realize it was quite as bad as it was. I knew that conditions on these ships could be dubious, but again, I didn't realize quite how bad they were. It was a very stratified class society, which sounds like if you were sitting on top, must have been, oh, so lovely. But if you were at the bottom, geez, it sounds horrendous that you'd have to deal with. As you said, all these long sailing distances sounded mind-boggling. You might be gone for 3 years, and you might not even return. They said that of the 2,000-plus men who sailed on this expedition, about one-tenth of them returned. That seemed horrifying to me, that the death rate was so incredibly high with this. And then the battles, I mean, if a cannonball flew by and blopped off your head or took your arm, they would do surgery, they would cut off your arm, and you'd probably die from the shock. It just sounded monstrous. I think this was a good book all in all. This author's previous book, Killers of the Flower Moon, was made into a movie, which is interesting because it too was a nonfiction book. I wonder if they'll make this one into a movie. We'll have to wait and see, I suppose.
Okay. Good comments. All right. Let's see. Kathy Snyder.
Well, I sort of liked it and sort of got bored by part of it, but there was so much I didn't know that was very interesting. I mean, I knew little bits, but not like what is explained. I thought the research was fabulous, and this guy's a good author.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad we read it.
Okay. Yeah, I had to read it. It did get a little long, so I mean,
Boy or masculine book to me, the story and all. And so that's
right.
You know, not my typical book that I read, but plus it was horrifying.
Yeah, definitely.
David said it was horrifying.
Yeah,
in many places.
Definitely that. Yeah. Okay, let's see. Michelle.
Yes. Well, David, to answer your question, Martin Scorsese, who directed Killers of the Flower Moon, optioned this material.
I'm not surprised.
I don't know if he's going to be making it into a movie, but he did do one with Killers of the Flower Moon. So
yeah, that came out not too long ago.
Very, very cinematic. Yeah. That's for sure. I was pretty impressed at how he put this book together. because, you know, all this documentation is from hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
And it's a little from this person and a little from that person, the log books and diaries and things like that. I thought it was pretty impressive that he could actually put this whole story together. I don't know how he did it. I was amazed. It was pretty gruesome in places. It was pretty graphic. It was really an incredible story. And how these people, any of these people, could have returned under these circumstances back to where they started from is just very unbelievable. I particularly like the legal proceedings that they talked about at the end. I found them really interesting. They had a 13-judge panel, which seemed like an awful lot of judges to me. The sailors were not represented by counsel, which I'm guessing at that time was not the way things were done. And it looked like they kind of wanted to sweep this whole incident under the rug. Like whatever happened, they really weren't investigating too much. So I wish he would have expanded a little bit more on that area, because I found that fascinating. But maybe he did what he, you know, what was available. But again, you know, considering what the source material must have been for this, this was very impressive writing, you know, piecing this together. But it was, you know, and moments it was pretty difficult to read, but it is. And I described this to somebody as a dad book, like it's the kind of book that you give your dad for Father's Day. Cause I kind of agree with Kathy. I don't know that women naturally gravitate towards this material, but I will say it was very well done.
Good deal. Good points. Good points. Thank you. Okay. Liz Lindsay.
Okay, I'll take a turn at this here.
Okay, go ahead, Lynn. Okay.
It's okay?
Yeah, it's fine. Hey, Liz didn't talk, so go ahead.
Okay. This was really, I enjoyed this book as much as somebody can enjoy a book like this. of course, because it was such a short book of 8 hours, you know, I ended up reading Bob Woodward's Peril also. And then once I got through with that, you know, I was still, I also read The Killers of the Flower Moon, which is on Bard also. So I read that too. Okay. And what was, I was kind of laughing at myself while I was listening to y'all talk, because there's no common thing between Bob Woodward's Peril and the book that we were assigned to read, Wager, other than the title. I just thought maybe the title of would have been a good title for to have it be Peril, because they were in a lot of peril at the on this ship. I didn't enjoy the deplorable conditions, but I was getting off on it. Because it seems like, oh no, it's not another naval book that we got, or maritime book that we have to read. And usually by the time I get finished with the book, it's either I'm screaming to myself, get me off this ship, get me off this ship. And then they get me out of this book, get me out of this book. You know, but I enjoyed, I mean, it was just a lot of knowledge for me that I had no clue whatsoever what kind of deplorable conditions there were in. And on every ship, sailing ship back in those days, from the Mayflower to the Santa Maria and the Pinta, Columbus's ships, you know, it was, you know, deplorable conditions. I really got off on, I really enjoyed the description of the press and impressment. Well, I've touched on it in other books, but I've never seen it in this quite of a detail of them. And this is where we get the word for our news media, as they go and press the whatever administration or whatever politician they're trying to go out and find more information about it. They are pressing them. The news media is pressing them to get them to give out more information. And I thought that was fascinating. I also, at the end of the book, close to the end of the book, when these people, you know, got back to England, and they all seemed to have to start writing their own book. And that kind of reminded me of after the Trump administration, everybody started writing their own book to tell them, you know, how bad it was, or what was good about the Trump administration, or most about how bad this Trump administration is. Well, let me give Liz a chance. I appreciated this book, and whoever picked it, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks. Good comments. Liz, do you have some comments to make?
She's not this. I don't know. I felt bad for the John Duck, the African seaman who got sold into slavery.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
I felt bad for him.
Yeah.
Then he disappeared.
One thing I noticed that I forgot to comment on, this is apropos of nothing, but it's just amazing what you focus on. I was amazed that it was 4 hours and 20 minutes into the book when they're talking about, you know, the Byron guy, and they start talking about, you know, Lord Byron, and they mentioned that he wrote Don Juan. I mean, am I the only one that's pronounced that Don Juan? I mean, Don Juan.
It's supposed to be Don Juan. It rhymes with that's just the way they pronounced it. It would normally be Don Juan if you were in Spanish, but Byron's poem is pronounced Don Juan because.
Is it really?
Okay. Yeah, as weird as that is, yes, it is.
And what's it rhyming with?
Like, he was never a true one, Don Juan. That's that upper class British thing. They don't have to speak correct French or Spanish. They figure the world will figure them out.
Okay, well, that's.
I didn't realize Byron's grandfather had been a vice admiral or something. He sounded like a trip, foul weather Jack.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, well, thanks for correcting me because I heard that Don.
It's an easy mistake to make.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well,
Liz is still muted. Does she need help to get unmuted?
I wouldn't think so. She goes to a lot of meetings, so she ought to know how to unmute herself.
I guess she knows, unless her thing is.
She might be like on the phone or something like that.
Yeah,
maybe so.
I think she's occupied. So, Don, were you ever able to get unmuted? Do you want to say a few words for your group here?
Yeah, before we play my announcement. Oh.
Hey, Don's still muted.
Yep.
The mute gremlin's got him.
I wonder if he'd do better on the phone in the future than he just do *6.
I thought you could hold the space bar down and it would temporarily.
You're supposed to be able to, yes.
On the computer. Yeah, I thought so. Well, I don't know. It's 2 minutes to the hour. How long is David's promo? You want to go ahead and play it, Brad?
Think it'll fit.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Go ahead and play it.
Hang on. Here we go.
Hello and welcome to Journey Through History for Tuesday, December 5th, 2023. Journey with us as we discover the world of Ming Dynasty China through a female physician.
I'll have to find that.
In her Lady Tan's Circle of Women, noted novelist Lisa C. opens a window on a world few of us have ever encountered. Join me as we explore this world in Lady Tan's Circle of Women, DB115160.
This is Don Queen, and that is a short by what I've read so far, and the book is excellent. So,
good. It's okay, Don.
Yeah. Well, Don, do you want to
catch the author? Who was the author,
Lisa,
David?
Lisa C.
I have that on my list of books to read, and I haven't read it yet, and this is a good excuse for me to read it because I've been wanting to, but so many book clubs, so little time.
Yeah, so well, David always picks good stuff, so I'm sure it'll be good. So yeah,
her novel Snowflower and the Something Fan was made into a movie.
I read that too.
Yeah, she's interesting. Several. And we've not done Ming Dynasty China. I wanted to take us somewhere really exotic, so that's it.
I didn't know that book was made into a movie.
Yeah, Snowflower, whatever, the Snowflower and the fan thing.
Yes.
So Don, now that you're unmuted, do you want to say anything about the wager or not?
Before we sign off?
The wager, it was a real page, Junior. That was very true. You know, I read a lot of the sea stories from Patrick O'Brien and the rest of them, but that guy really gets towards the end, he gets up on his political stuff a little bit, but he did a real good author. I'm going to have to read his book on the Osage Indians.
Yeah, I want to too now.
Yeah, yeah, Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great book.
I love the title.
Well, that was a great interview that you had for the recording, and I love the opening and ending sea shanties too. So that was a nice so that was very well done. But anyway.
Well, Don, it's so good to hear your voice. It's Joni speaking.
Yeah,
I've got to go now.
Nice to hear. Hear you again too.
Thank you.
I've heard you all along. You get into better than I do.
Oh, okay. Are we done, people? Any last minute words and stuff? Let's see. We've got what else is coming up soon? We're going to be talking banquet. This is Sunday. That's right. Yep. So everybody come to banquet Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern.
Your thing.
Yep, 4 p.m. Central. And then we're discussing They're Watching by Greg Hurwitz and Worlds of Books. And then I guess Liz must have – I can't remember the name of that book we're doing for Liz. It's got something to do with cooking or something.
It's Swamp Sweets.
Swamp Sweets. Well, there you are. Did you want to say anything about the wager or not?
Oh, I actually enjoyed the book. Yeah, sorry, I missed my turn. I enjoyed it. It's not something that I would have picked up on my own.
Right.
But I find myself amazed that anybody survived at all. About halfway through, I could think, oh my God, I wonder if they survived. And then, of course they did. This is not a fiction, you know?
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, I can't even imagine being under such harsh circumstances. But yeah, I very much enjoyed it. And the narrator made it really interesting for me. He really I enjoyed that.
He was the author.
The author reads a little of it, but most of it is a commercial narrator.
Right.
But the author does read a little, the author's note the acknowledgments. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, thanks. Okay, guys, I gotta go.
Okay,
it was nice seeing you.
Thank you for coming.
You have a nice afternoon. Yeah. You have a nice evening.
Yeah, I'm like you, Liz. We keep talking about how high the death rate was. I'm amazed that even a single person came back alive from that thing. It's just, I'm just amazed by that. So,
oh, yeah.
That was terrible.
Can you all repeat the number again, the book number for the next read? I missed it.
Hang on. It's 115160, is that right?
Okay, one more time.
Go, David. You got it. You have it memorized, I think.
I had some of it. 115. Did you say 860 or 160?
160. Yeah, 115160.
The 45-second promo. We'll play it again.
115160.
He only says the demon once. So.
Yeah, I was bad.
Yeah.
And it's Lisa C.
And it's
red. How do you spell S-E-E, C?
Like the verb. S-E.
Yeah.
Oh, he's gone.
Yeah. And Jennifer Lynn narrates, it looks like. So, and the reading time is 13 hours, 6 minutes.
Long enough, but not horrible.
Yeah, not horrible.
No, enough. Not bad. I'll know now to start on it early. I wish I'd thought of the other one.
Be warned, it gets into some graphical foot binding stuff that grossed me out, but that was
that's normal in China, though.
Yeah,
that's what they did.
Back then.
Those poor women. Yes. Oh, that sounded monster, that barbaric.
Yep.
It was barbaric, and the women suffered in pain.
That's what they said. They could hardly walk, and they hurt.
They could die from it. You found in the book.
Unbelievable.
Yep, the mother did.
Yeah. That's horrible.
All righty, I'm gonna say goodnight because I'm
already read the book. Here.
Okay.
You already read the book. Whoever said that felt the.
I've read it.
Yes, the other
girl. I can remember her name.
Yes, Kathy, it's me.
Yeah.
I already found it at Target. I found it at Target this summer, and she's my favorite author. So I just grabbed it.
Any chapters. I can't figure out how much I need to read each day. I usually go by page numbers, but Bookshare doesn't put the page numbers in this one.
Oh.
I don't see chapters either. I got to figure out how to read it.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, good night to everybody.
All righty.
Hey,
everybody, take care.
You too.
Okay.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Shut her down. See you next month.
All right.
Bye, Brad.
Bye-bye.